Majors & Quinn presents
Blair Braverman.
So tonight, I am very excited to welcome Blair Braverman to our store. She is the author of Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube. We are also welcoming Queen, her sled dog, one of her sled dogs here. She is an absolute sweetie. I first met Blair at a bookseller's conference where one of the activities was essentially speed dating for authors of upcoming books and booksellers. And I was like, wow, Blair is amazing. Her story seems really amazing. Then, you know, I got home and I actually read the book and I was like, I could not wait to get her in the store. And then we were fortunate enough to actually book her for an event. So I've been looking forward to this reading for a really long time. And if you don't know much about Blair or her book yet, you're really in for a treat. And I'm really excited that we're able to share this opportunity with you. So Blair graduated from the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program, where she was also an arts fellow. She has been a resident fellow at Blue Mountain Center and the McDowell Colony, and her work has appeared in BuzzFeed, The Best Women's Travel Writing, AGNI, High Country News, Waging Nonviolence, and On This American Life. She's also done many other really awesome things in her life, as you've probably heard, dog sledding, which she will get to when she talks about her memoir, Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube. With that, please join me in welcoming Blair Braverman.
I love so much that there's dogs in attendance here. This is actually my first reading ever. So the book just came out last week. It's my first book. So thank you. And Sarah right there was at the speed dating thing back in March or whenever it was. And she received my first signed galley. And she had to tell me which page to sign on. And now she's here and I feel like she's going to tell me what I'm doing wrong. Or right. Thank you. And this is Queen. I brought her out. She's one of my sled dogs. I'm a nonfiction writer. I do journalism, essays, any kind of nonfiction, I guess. And I'm also a dog sledder. I live in northern Wisconsin, and I'm training for the Iditarod as of this spring. So Queen, believe it or not, will hopefully run 1,100 miles across the state of Alaska with me. In about a year and a half. She can walk around. And she also hasn't been in a city before. But she is house trained, unlike most sled dogs. So this book, Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube, I didn't really know what it was going to be when I started writing it. I thought of it as a kind of standard adventure story. That was how I sold it. That's how I pitched it. That's what I thought I would write. And the more I started writing it, the more it sucked. And it became clear to me. I grew up in California. I moved to the Arctic when I was 16 for the first time. And I've since lived there for several years, gone back and forth as much as possible, determined to get into dog sledding and figure things out. And the reason I realized that the book was flat and sucked was because the adventure wasn't really about the adventure. It was about why I was obsessed with that place, which for me had a lot to do with gender and coming out of a abusive situation and then trying to sort of control the fear that I had in my life so that it wasn't fear that was out of my control or confusing. It was like fear of hypothermia, fear of falling into a crevasse. These types of fear that I certainly was susceptible to, but that felt much more manageable to me and that I was drawn to. So once I really started looking into that, the book became what it was meant to be, which was terrifying. The whole time I wrote it, I told myself no one was ever going to read it. And now it's been out for a week and people are reading it. And it's I've had really good responses. So I'm going to read two parts today. I'm going to read from the prologue, and then I'll jump into some actual adventure. I will say the book, even though I'm a dog sledder, that's a huge part of my life. I have 20 huskies. I spend hours a day year-round taking care of them. I'm the primary racer in my kennel. Queen and her sisters are among my... I don't have favorites. And the book has dog sledding at the cover. There's actually very little dog sledding in the book. That is a sort of drive getting into that, but I'd say it's about 20% of the book. A lot of the book is about this tiny village of 40 people up 200 miles above the Arctic Circle in Norway, which is a place I sort of came to rest by accident. And it is largely made up of former seal hunters, sort of aging bachelors who became unemployed when the seal hunting industry collapsed up in Norway, which they blame on Brigitte Bardot, by the way. And so I spent on and off for about 3 years really becoming part of this community. I'm still in very close touch with them. And so that's where most of the book takes place, from this sort of odd village of relative safety that allowed me to sort through what had brought me there in the first place. So I will start right here at the beginning. I'm going to read for about 30 minutes and then open it up to questions. "I'm sick," said Martin. He sat hunched in a folding chair before the bonfire. It was St. Hans's night, midsummer, and the sun hung small and orange over the northern horizon, like a sullen child not quite willing to leave the room. Across the fjord, a line of tiny fires flickered between the water and the hills. "I'm sorry to hear that," I said. Martin pushed himself up and came to stand before me. "Did they tell you?" he said. "I bet they didn't tell you. Didn't want to scare you away, a nice Pia like yourself. You don't even know what it's like. I'm going to die soon. If God has a heart, I'm going to die soon." I was looking at the fire behind him, I realized, and made myself look up at his face. He was maybe 60. His body seemed full of bones. "I can't even fuck a woman," Martin said. "I'm going to die soon, and I can't even fuck a woman." "Yeah, just drink your cider. Drink it while you can. You don't know what it's like to be in pain." As if on cue, he stiffened and moaned, biting his lip hard. Then he caught his breath. "I could have fucked you," he said, quietly. "Once in my life, I sure could have fucked you." He seemed to expect a response, so I tried to think of one. Fear seemed appropriate, a show of being intimidated. The proper gift for a dying man. Could he have fucked me? It made me tired to consider. I thought of another man the day before who had wrapped his arms around me from behind. "Treasure," he'd whispered, "you're north of the moral circle now." "Let me show you," said Martin. With white hands, he fumbled the button of his canvas pants. Behind him, sparks rose toward the blue sky. "You don't need to show me," I said. "I believe you." "No, you don't," said Martin. "Look." He pulled down his waistband to reveal two curving white hip bones and a colostomy bag half full. He prodded the bag with his fingers so that it sloshed. Across the fire, Martin's son and daughter-in-law were kissing, their legs entangled. Arling in black leather with a stiff mustache, Berit dressed from head to toe in a pink leather motorcycle suit. I'd heard rumors about her, that she was Sami royalty, the daughter of the man who owned more reindeer than anyone else in Lapland. Their two toddlers rolled in the sand. Another man, Runa, was down by the water with an armful of sticks, half bent over, his free arm extended toward a piece of driftwood. It was Runa who'd invited me to the bonfire. A party, he'd promised. A good time. Now he stood frozen, watching Martin. He seemed to have forgotten what he was reaching for. Martin tugged his pants lower, revealing pale, hairless genitals. "You see what I have to live with?" All right, said Barrett, looking up from her husband. She's seen it. Martin zipped his pants. I just want her to understand. You like the cider? Runa had come back over and stood beside me. There's five more. I got them just for you. The others drink beer, but I thought maybe you don't like beer. Maybe we can start the salmon now. You like salmon, true? He was talking more than usual and slurred. He kept glancing at me and then glancing away. Who is she? Said Barrett. Where did you find her? It was a fair question, and the hard answer, the real answer, stretched back 15 years and 4,000 miles through blizzards and open tundra, smothering ice caves and the pulsing northern lights, many nights alone and some, unmercifully, not. I was a 24-year-old girl from California, camped in a tiny village in the Norwegian Arctic. I had lived here once before, and it had helped me restore some lost courage. Now I'd come back years later, and I needed that courage more than ever. I just didn't know how to get it. The truth was that Runa had found me because I was hoping that somebody, anybody, would. The simpler answer was that Runa had found me at the local shop, and I'd found the shop because of a wool sweater 6 years before. At the time, I was a student at a local folk school, 18 years old and learning to dog sled. I had come to the Arctic for adventure, but I also carried with me a circular logic. If I could be safe in this land, maybe I could be safe in my own body. If I could protect my body, maybe I could live in this land. So far, though, I was not doing anything right. To start with, I had no wool sweaters, and wool sweaters in the Northland were of nearly religious significance. If it was 30 below and you were cold, it was your own fault because your sweater wasn't wool. Or if your sweater was wool, then maybe your shirt wasn't. Maybe your bra wasn't. I didn't own any wool at all, so I went to the nearby shop in hope of finding some. Okay, so that is the first couple pages from the prologue. And I am going to I'm going to skip ahead to something that happened before that, which is the folk school that I mentioned, which is a kind of weird Scandinavian education system, like socialist, very sort of philosophical. They're year-long boarding schools that are free, where students study anything that is impractical. That is the stated point. And the idea behind them originally, they started in Denmark, which prides itself as, you know, the perfect democracy. And about 100 years ago, they decided that they couldn't be a perfect democracy because maybe their citizens didn't really know themselves, like in their heart of hearts. They didn't know themselves. So how could their votes be honest? So they created this year-long school program so that people would learn the least pleasant things about themselves and therefore become better voters. I swear to God, this is the origin of this institution. And now there's about 200 of them still around Scandinavia. So I went to the smallest one, which was focused on dog sledding and winter survival. That's my friend Lefty. Hi, Lefty. She's the only person I knew for sure was going to come to this. So I went to this folk school, and I didn't know that the whole point was to put the students in danger and in very uncomfortable situations repeatedly over the course of the year, so that we would know our least pleasant characteristics. So we're at that school, and I'm learning to dog sled, and my dog sledding teacher is named Talak. Let's see. Okay, so this is at the end of the year. Okay. Okay, I'm actually going to start a little bit earlier and give you guys more context. I'd have this figured out if it were my second reading. So I'm 18 years old. I've just sort of arrived in the Arctic with a bunch of strangers. The school program opened with a lamb banquet, held around long tables in an upstairs gymnasium that smelled like pine sol and wet wool. I found myself sitting next to Sven, the wilderness teacher, a gorgeous Dane who, it was whispered, had come to 69 degrees north, it's the name of the school, after police found him wandering in the forest months after a breakup with only an elk hound for company. At one point, when someone mentioned camping, Sven climbed onto his chair in excitement. After dinner, the principal took the podium. He spoke of adventure, of learning the rhythms of the polar night, of learning the howls of dogs and the textures of snow. He spoke of bonding into the kind of community made possible only through isolation and hardship. The principal wore black pants and no shirt. He had binder clips pinched to his nipples, and occasionally, as he talked, he tweaked the clips with his fingers. He was proud of his tolerance for pain. He wore this outfit on the opening night because he wanted to encourage bravery, and how could he tell his students to be brave without demonstrating his own courage first? For the rest of the year, the principal wore tidy jeans and button-down shirts. He only busted out the binder clips for special occasions. When the principal finished talking, the students cheered. Sven pounded the table. After a moment, I pounded on the table too, joining the ovation. I was in the Arctic, and in the Arctic, things happened for a reason. I felt that nothing could surprise me. The world seemed strange and bright. Most of my classes that year were taught by the dog sledding teacher, Tallak, a compact Sami man with a gift of authority. Everything Tallak said, everyone believed. It wasn't that he was forceful or overwhelming. Rather, his voice carried a calm certainty, slow and light, punctuated by little laughs. Listening to him talk about anything, dogs, racism, foster children, Christmas, felt like discovering brilliant thoughts you didn't know you already had. "I have to be careful," he sometimes said, "because people will believe whatever I tell them." This show of responsibility only made the students trust him more. Skipping ahead. Nowhere were his Tallak's lessons more urgent than in the kennel. Tallak's dogs were fighters. Almost daily, they broke into terrible screaming brawls, and we had to come running from the school or the cabins and pull tight fists of fur from their backs and kick their ribs with our boots. I was always scared to enter the mass of flying heads and teeth and blood and would hold back, hoping for someone else to break up the fight first. But then Tallak called me out. "They're hurting each other and you just stand there?" And I was ashamed. His dogs were valuable, 10,000 kroner each, maybe more. We should have no reluctance, he told us, to be rough with them, and as with everything he told us, we were embarrassed to have ever not believed it. Manhandling dogs was simply learning to speak their language rather than expecting them to learn ours. To grab a dog by its scruff and whip it onto its back, then kneel on its chest until its muscles finally relaxed. That was being the boss. Tallak showed us how to grip our hands around the dog's snouts, to growl deep in our throats and bite their noses and ears. He liked to tell a story about being stuck in a kennel with a strange dog who was snarling, bent on attacking him. He grabbed a shovel, raised it to the sky, and brought it down on the dog's head. The dog fell to the ground. And then, Tallak said, he unzipped his pants and peed on it. If that wasn't dog language, he didn't know what was. We didn't either. None of the students was inclined toward roughness, but neither were we inclined to question Tallak's wisdom. So I found out when I went to other kennels that that was very atypical. And I would not have remained in the sport if that was typical. But it is what I first came into as an 18-year-old, trying to fit in a very tough landscape. Does someone know what time it is? Oh, great. As a culmination of our winter training, I just want to be really clear that I don't endorse that. Just, I don't know. I see it's like the new reading. I'm not sure. But that was shocking to us, and I was also shocked and very grateful when I went to the next kennel I worked at after that and found it utterly different. And every kennel since then. As a culmination of our winter training, Tallak arranged a trip to Svalbard, the barren archipelago halfway between mainland Norway and the pole, where he knew of some sled dogs we could borrow. I could hardly believe my own life. Svalbard was legendary, sharp and ethereal, that particularly Arctic combination of spectacular and austere. Short of an expedition to the pole, I could go no farther north, no closer to the top of the world. It was March. The sun there had not yet risen. For a few days we hung around the primary settlement, Longyearbyen, where fat reindeer shuffled down the main street. Then we rented some dogs and an armed guide, in case of polar bears, and set off into the interior. That night, atop a glacier, we made an unusual camp, a cluster of tents with the dogs staked in a ring around us. The dogs were not in a circle so they would fight off a bear. They were in a circle so that the bear, when it reached us, would already have a full stomach. I volunteered for the first watch shift, from 10 to 12, to get it over with. My headlamp was dim. It didn't illuminate past the first row of dogs. "How will I know if there's a bear?" I asked the guide. "The dogs will know." "And then?" "Wake me up. I'll sleep with the gun." He stepped into the nearest tent, zipped it shut after him. All around, students in the other tents were closing down, flies zipping, lights switching off, the first snores filtering out into the night. I stomped my boots, kicked at the wind-packed snow, shook my hands to keep warm. Somewhere across camp was the other watch, but I couldn't see her. My headlamp flickered. It was too cold for batteries. I switched it off and waited for my eyes to adjust. There were no stars, no northern lights, but the land was too white to ever be pitch black, no matter how dark it got. Instead, the snow, the mountains, the sky, everything was gray. I stood suspended in it. Gradually, I could make out the tents. The dogs were small mounds curled in nests of snow. "Somewhere nearby," I thought, "is a polar bear. Polar bears eat people. Eat them." Just when I thought I'd been getting used to things. "Should we worry?" my mother had asked me after I first arrived at the school. I'd assured her that she shouldn't. I loved her dearly, but her worry felt intrusive. Now she would worry about me. Now that I was facing challenges I wanted. But I hadn't said that. Instead, I'd made an appeal more hopeful than logical, pointing out the threats that were lessened here. Car crashes? Terrorism? The flu? The dangers here were different, I argued, but no worse than the dangers at home. It was simply an adjustment. I promised not to be stupid. The truth was that when it came down to it, the land here seemed kind, and that kindness seemed to be the great secret of the Arctic, at least on the mainland. All its dangers distilled into one crisp feature: cold. And what was cold but a call to the moment? Cold couldn't creep or consume, stalk or drown. It necessitated only insulation. The things that survival demanded, covering our bodies, keeping them separate from other bodies, were the things I already wanted to do. In extreme cold, nobody thought of any body but their own. Nobody would think about mine, wrapped in its layers upon layers. Of course, there was the matter of keeping warm, but after months of winter, even cold was easily solved. To live in cold, I had only to internalize its counterintuitive rules. When my body wanted to clench, I had to force it open. Swing my arms when I wanted to pull them in. Jump when I wanted to sit. Pee when I would rather stay clothed. Change into dry long underwear even when the air bit my bare limbs. Cold was the mind's distraction and the body's one demand. Of course I was scared, but at least I was scared of dangers of my own choosing. At least there was joy that came with it. I walked to the edge of the ring of dogs and stared into the gray, searching for movement. I squinted into the dark. "Are you safe?" "I'm as safe as I'll ever be." And the dogs exploded. It happened all at once. The dogs were lying curled in their mounds, and then they were shrieking, growling, screaming with an energy I had never heard before. I hit the side of my headlamp and shone the beam around the circle, but all I could see was the dogs' tense bodies and the snow that swirled around them. The guide, I thought, the gun. But my limbs felt weak. I kept sweeping my light around me. Dogs, dogs, and now the guide was beside me with his rifle high, shouting something I could barely make out. Where were the dogs looking? And I realized with horror that they weren't facing an approaching danger, something they'd scented on the wind. Whatever the dogs were barking at, it was already inside the circle. I turned around and swept my light. Snow, dogs, tents, nothing. They were barking at nothing. But their hackles were straight in the air. The guide saw it first. It was a dog, one of the closest dogs, a little black one named Lucifer. He was on his side, convulsing. The guide ran to him, and I and the others, scrambling from their tents, ran to him too, and held his legs as the guide instructed us. Lucifer was twitching, his mouth foaming, his body shaking in a way no dog's body should. But I kept looking over my shoulder. What about the bear? The dogs didn't quiet until Lucifer lay still. Epilepsy, said the guide, breathing hard. We've tried everything for it. He stroked Lucifer's side with one hand. He was limp. A ring had gathered, students blinking in their yanked-on boots, shaky with adrenaline and sleepiness. Slowly they traipsed back to their tents. I still had 40 minutes left in my shift. And then I was alone again. The night had a different quality now, the ringing of silence after noise. I was tired, but dreaded climbing into my tent to sleep, where I'd lie pressed among three classmates. Even after months of practice, I couldn't sleep well with other bodies close around me. I was too conscious of their breathing. I woke at small movements. And since I was restless anyway and revved up, I decided to make myself a snow cave and sleep alone, where at least I'd get some solid rest. Besides, the digging would keep me warm. I chose a spot and started to dig with an avalanche rescue shovel. A sharp, low wind was picking up. It blew straight across the snowfield, blurring the ground with blown snow. It felt like standing in a cloud. The cave was nothing fancy. I had made a dozen like it before. How you doing, Queen? First, I dug a hole straight down, chest deep. Then I hopped into the hole and began to carve a tunnel sideways from the bottom, extending out in an L shape. This was the chamber I would sleep in, a cocoon just long and wide enough for my sleeping bag, just tall enough that if I lifted my head, my nose scraped the ceiling. I finished about the time that the next watch, my friend Iselin, stumbled from her tent. I wished her luck, then started the long process of maneuvering into the hole. First, standing in the vertical entryway, I put on... I'm going to skip, actually, how I got into the hole. That doesn't seem important at this moment. Finally, horizontal, I propped my backpack behind my head to trap the warm air. The wind moaned across the mouth of the hole. For a split second, I felt a flash of panic. I was lying in a coffin. No, I wasn't. I took a deep breath and turned off my headlamp. The snow hugged me from all sides. I wrenched my arm from my sleeping bag and touched in the darkness the ceiling a few inches above my face. It was slick, like ice. Already my breath had smoothed it. I was warm. I was comfortable. I was, I hoped, polar bear proof. I was in a shelter I had made myself to take care of myself. I was at the top of the world. I was, wasn't I, tough. The thoughts relaxed my still racing heart, and before I could think much more, I fell asleep. What's our time? I'll read one more page, just to be mean. You don't know what's coming. I woke to voices and footsteps far above me. Where is she? She never came in the tent last night. It was pitch black, and I couldn't move. My sleeping bag cinched tight.
Hi, honey.
My sleeping bag cinched tight around my face, so that only my nose poked out. But I couldn't reach up to untie it. No room to bend my arm, and something was blocking my hand. Oh, a baffle cinched around my neck. I fumbled to release the bow that tied the baffle, then reached my face and untied that too. Cool air stroked my forehead. Where was my light? More voices now. Did you see her? My light was on my chest. I switched it on. Two flickers and then a dim circle appeared on the snow just above me. Much too cramped in here. Got to roll over. I shimmied against the ground, landed face down, and arched my back to lift my head. The snow was lumpy under me, hardened to the shape of my body. I wiped off my face. There was my backpack, empty. I reached out one hand to shove it away so I could climb out. But the bag didn't move. I snaked my hand past it and felt packed snow. Fully awake in an instant, I understood. I saw in a series of flashes last night's wind sweeping snow across the plain. The snow packed layer upon layer into the entrance to my hole. The entrance smoothed over as if it were never there. And then, flashing forward, I saw myself trying to dig into the tunnel with my hands, burrowing my way out and the packed snow expanding as I scraped it from the wall, filling my airspace, smothering me before I could reach the surface. My light was flickering again. I switched it off, lay still in the darkness. Then I pulled my arm back into my sleeping bag and re-knotted the neck baffle. I couldn't move. Shouldn't lose warmth. 1, 2, 3, as loud as I could. Help! Nothing. I'm gonna stop there. thank you. You know, you'll have to buy the book to find out. I don't know. So I'm happy to take any questions now.
Can you attend the folk schools that you'd mentioned free as an American?
They are open. I had to work weekends to pay for my room and board, but that's doable.
How long were you living up north?
I went back and forth as much as I can. I'd stay until my visa ran out. I was there for about 5 years total, and a lot of that was, 3 of those years were whole years, and then the other time was 3 to 6 months at a time, and then I'd go home and save up money and go back.
Are you using what you learned from your experience to earn a living today?
That's how I spend money. I wouldn't say I make my living. That's how I get dog food for her. But my life very much, I mean, it's interesting because I did settle into a kind of northern place in Wisconsin. I've ended up on a farm. I live with my fiance. We have 35 acres. We have sled dogs. It's not quite as cold as the Arctic, but it's actually pretty close. It's usually about 5 degrees warmer in the winter. So I'm living a kind of northern life near here, which shouldn't surprise any of you.
Will the old seal hunters that you mentioned read your book?
Oh, they're fighting over it. Yeah, the first book that I got, because they sent me one hardcover, I turned around and mailed it to them. And I'm sending them more, but then I got a call from these seal hunters in the Arctic, and they're like fighting over whether I said nice things about each of them in the acknowledgments. And Otold, who's the shopkeeper there, who I dedicated the book to, hasn't read it yet because he keeps lending it out to people. But I'm going to he desperately wants to sell it in his shop, so I'm going to send him a big box. And I know he'll just give it away because he's terrible at making money.
When you were in the North, did you or the people you were working with know you'd be writing a book about the experience?
I did, because at that point I was working as a writer. I mean, I was making my living by selling freelance stories. And so I had an idea that whatever I did, I would try to write about it. But I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know it was going to be this book. So I told them I was writing a book. I didn't know what it was. And most of the conversations are verbatim because I was writing them down or tape recording them as they happened, even though they're not interviews. Like the conversation at the beginning where Walter's like, I changed his name. Martin's like, I could have fucked you. Like that's verbatim. I was sitting there with a notebook writing it all down. And they didn't care. I think they thought I was sort of delusional. And they're used to people who they think are delusional up there. And so people would come up to me and they'd be like, oh, I hear you're writing a book. Like, I have a cousin whose friend lives in the States, but they're from here, so maybe they'll read your book about this place. They really felt sorry for me, I think. But they're excited now about it.
How does someone born and raised in California decide they want to live in the cold like that?
It's a good question, and I don't have a great answer for it. I just was, like, when I was a kid, my favorite book was Balto. It sounds like... Now it sounds like that's a cliche when I look back on it, but it was. Like, I had this, like, learn to read Balto book, and I was obsessed with it. And my parents hated California. They weren't from there. And every time I mentioned California being our home, they would both say in unison, "We don't live here," even though, you know, the family was there for 20 years. So I think that I was looking for a place to attach to, and I was kind of looking for a place that was the opposite of the California that everyone in my family complained about all the time. So actually, when I was a kid and in high school, I figure skated pretty much every day. And I think that was like the coldest thing I could find in California. I got to go like be on an ice rink every day.
How did you get started as a writer?
You know, I used to do a lot of visual art. When I was growing up, I thought I'd be a visual artist. But I've always written about things, and I've always kept, like, a ton of journals, and it just became clear. When I graduated from undergrad, I studied environmental law. So I applied half to environmental law graduate programs and half to MFAs, and I told myself I was only applying to the MFAs to see if I was good enough to get in, and... Then by the time the results came in, I was, you know, I had options in both category, and I realized I was very much hoping that I wouldn't get into any environmental law programs and that I'd only get into MFAs. So that was when I really decided, okay, I'm going to try to make a career out of this.
What was the journey to publish your memoir like?
I feel like I'm supposed to have these, like, good answers, but the answer is that I was like 2 years into my MFA and felt like I needed a job when I graduated. And so I was like, I need to sell some book, but I didn't know what I was writing. So I wrote a proposal for a book that was called Welcome to the Goddamn Ice Cube, and I sold it. And then for the next 4 years, that was 4 years ago, I wrote it. And the book that I turned in does not resemble the book that I proposed to write at all. It has like maybe 10 pages out of 300 or, you know, what I thought I would do. So I sort of cornered myself into writing the book and then into writing a book. And then I saw where that took me. I want to write my next book about apocalypse preppers. That's what I decided last week. If anyone knows any.
You'd mentioned feelings of trying to be tough. Do you think of yourself as tough now?
I was obsessed with the phrase tough girl when I was a teenager, and even when I was in my very early 20s and I went back, sort of the time period that most of this book covers, I was obsessed with that idea. It seemed, because someone had written to me, who I hardly knew, and said, the topic of tough girls came up, and I thought about you and wondered if life has been kind to you. And it was someone I'd only known when I was in a very bad home situation and had never talked to. It was like a classmate. And so I became fascinated with the idea that at this time I had felt most vulnerable. Someone who I didn't know had identified me as tough enough that 6 years later I would come up and they would ask me if I was okay and like track down my email. That was so meaningful, but I couldn't make sense of it because it seemed so unlikely. And I was interested in the implied contradiction, right? Tough girl. It's, you know, strong woman. We've heard that so much that it's meaningless, essentially. I mean, it's just a phrase. But something about tough girl grabbed me, and I wanted that desperately. I wanted to be able to feel comfortable in being a girl and also like I could go do what I wanted and wouldn't be shaken by it the way I felt shaken by things in my life. So that was a huge driving force, that phrase. And I have no idea. Like, I cannot access that emotion now. By the time I finished writing the book, I was like, that is the most trite phrase. It means nothing. I have no emotional response to it. It's so boring. Like, I had no response to the phrase tough girl. I don't now. I think it's so boring. I, like, feel bad telling you about it. But I had to go back because it had been an idea that motivated me during these events. So I had to go back and try to understand what it was that obsessed me so much with that idea. So now I don't worry about being tough, I guess. I'm not trying to prove myself to anyone, except for, like, my dogs, I guess. I want to live up to their expectations.
Is your dog a typical sled dog? It looks different than what I had imagined.
She's an Alaskan Husky. And an Alaskan Husky is not a Siberian Husky. And I get asked anywhere I go with my sled dogs. People come up and ask what kind of dog they are. So this is a PSA. Sled dogs don't actually look like Slobirians, we call them. Slobirians are show dogs. Sled dogs, almost all mushers use Alaskan Huskies, which is like a nice word for working mutt of the North. They're like descendants of the village dogs. They don't have any standard look. Her sister is white and looks really different from her. Her dad looks different from her. They're very varied, but they're all love pulling. That is what they're born for. That's all they want to do. When they see the harness come out, I mean, they're like a Labrador if you pick up a tennis ball, like just annoyingly obsessed and thrilled. Yeah. Cover her ears when you say things like that. But what I was going to say is that she is an Alaskan Husky because Alaskan Husky is a mutt that pulls a sled. But her Alaskan Husky has some greyhound mixed in. That's why she's so long and pointy.
Are your dog's pink boots used to keep her feet warm?
No, they're not for warmth. Actually, what they do is they keep snow. They only wear them in certain textures of snow. But snow will clump into little balls and then get stuck between their toes and rub, almost like getting a pebble in your shoe. So they're not for warmth. They're only to provide a barrier so snow doesn't get between their toes. But I thought, you know, she wears them well. And you guys could see what she looks like when she's all dressed up to work.
Did you notice any evidence of climate change in the North? And do you speak fluent Norwegian?
Absolutely. Yes. I do speak fluent Norwegian. Over the course of this book, the people in this village speak an obscure dialect that is almost not understandable to most Norwegians. So I also learned to understand and speak that dialect. But at the beginning, it was a little iffy and I had to have people repeat things because they sounded weird to me. I just picked it up. When I was a teenager and went to Norway, I refused to speak English or read English or do anything in English until I had learned Norwegian. And I actually became pretty fluent in about a month and was able to get by in school and stuff. And I don't pick up other languages. I just Norwegian somehow. You know, I was born for it. I knew I wanted to go there and somehow it fits with my brain.
Did your parents let you go alone to Norway, and did it take much convincing?
They did, yes. Yeah. But now, the good things that have come of it, they're convinced it was their idea to start with. My parents, and they came up and visited me and are baffled. My dad's from the Bronx. but they, I think they're sort of delighted by how weird their daughter turned out.
Has your mom read the book, and does she know about the dangerous situations that you are in?
She knows the stories, and she knew I was writing it. But she was always grateful that there was a 9-hour time difference, because she figured that every time she was awake, I was safely asleep. And then she slept through the time of day when I was in danger. That was what she would tell herself.
Did you get any pushback on the title?
Yeah, so the title... For those of you who haven't read the book, and since I didn't read this section, I ended up living on a glacier for 7 months that was only accessible by helicopter in a tent city, and it was very, it was bizarre. I have a This American Life about it. Some of you may have hurt it, because apparently someone's dog bit me outside of CVS, which is the only dog bite I've gotten, and they were like, oh my god, you did the This American Life. But so I lived on this glacier, and on a good day people called it Welcome to the Goddamn Ice, or they called it the Goddamn Ice Cube, and on a good day they called it Summer Camp on the Moon. So that's the reference in the title. I didn't have any pushback. I was waiting for it. I was just holding my breath, waiting to fight for the title, and no one said anything in 4 years. I did fight for the subtitle, Finding Home in the Great White North. They wanted one woman's journey to discovery in the Arctic wilderness. Yeah, see, thank you. Thank you. I fought for a month on that one. I'm pretty proud of it. But no one batted an eye at the title.
What do you think millennials think about outdoor activities, and what would you say is the biggest thing that you learned through your experiences?
Oh god, both those questions are awful. More dogs. I don't, you know, in my, I really don't know how to answer those. I think a lot of it comes down to money and opportunity. I mean, I know that I can answer for dog sledding. I've had a lot of people in particularly the Midwestern dog sledding community who have really taken me under their wing and have been wonderful mentors. And I think in part that they're excited to see my fiance and I are a youngish couple in the sport, and they are, so people have been very generous with us. You know, just wonderful community has been very welcoming. And there is some, she's my friend, you can send the dog with her. There's not a lot of young people in dog sledding. There is an apprenticeship culture where young people work at someone else's kennel. So I did that for several years. That's very common. And I don't know that many places where a sort of apprenticeship system is common like that. But it takes land, and it takes stability, and it takes money, and it takes a huge time and energy commitment to have your own dog team. And that's hard to do when you're 20 or 30 or, you know, or 50 or 60 or 70. But I think that's the biggest hurdle. And for me, my fiance had a farm already. He bought it when he was 17. We have 35 acres. I would not have my dog team if I didn't marry into land. there's still, like, I still have all the other hurdles, and I was having a conversation with some of these guys earlier, how, like, a certain portion of my brain is always looking for free meat, because they eat so much, but the land was a big one. We have the land for it.
So is writing and dog sledding your full-time career?
I scrounged together money by making art, which everyone knows how easy that is. And then I spend all my money on the dogs. So whatever you want to call that. I do dog sled and write full time. I don't have another job. All of my time, it's fairly seasonal. For the summer 6 months, I'm writing as much as possible, or, you know, traveling with the book in this case. And then in the winter, I am out with the dogs about 8 to 10 hours a day.
How many dogs do you have? And can you talk about your other written works?
I don't know how many dogs I have. And that's because I have a litter of puppies right now, and they're 4.5 weeks old, and I'm not sure how many I'm keeping. I think I'm going to keep 4, but I'm not sure. So I probably have 16 dogs. And 2 of them just retired to a monastery to become monastery dogs. So I had 18 until about 3 weeks ago, where they're literally being fed steak on tablecloths in a castle. That's not an exaggeration at all. It's just absolutely what's happening to them. The other writing I've done, I've been working on this for 4 years, so it's been my main thing. But the biggest story I did, other than this, my friend called me up, who works at BuzzFeed, and she wanted me to profile a gay figure skater training for Sochi. And I was like, that'll be easy. Okay, I'll find one and profile him. No problem. And I could not find anyone. I couldn't find any out figure skaters training for Sochi. And that seemed odd to me because, you know, the editors had assumed and I had assumed growing up in the sport that it's sort of a gay haven within sports. So it became a kind of Frank Sinatra has a cold, for those of you who know that essay. It's good. I recommend it. Where the entire article, the entire thing that I spent several months researching and traveling and, you know, going to all the competitions and following the skaters, I was just sort of circling around these invisible gay skaters and trying to figure out why they weren't there. And also the sort of legacy of homophobia within the institution of the sport, which in some part comes from Russian culture, and that was the whole hook of the story at the time, was, you know, anti-gay laws in Russia. But that's the project that I'm most proud of, probably, other than that. And because it was BuzzFeed, the title is Why is the World's Gayest Sport Stuck in the Closet? And if you Google World's Gayest Sport, it comes up. Great. Thank you all so much. This was not nearly as scary as I thought.